Welcome to the Florida Roundup this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, today we are featuring several interviews that aired on previous shows. Later on in the hour, it's our conversation with veteran journalist Dan Rather about coming together as a nation.
We'll also listen back to a conversation that we had last summer over symbols of the Confederacy still in place and on display in Florida. But first, the highest court in Florida and social media. Things are happening here, Melissa, that are pretty interesting in the 21st century. This month, the state Supreme Court ruled that judges and lawyers can be Facebook friends without violating their independence. You know, state rules require judges to avoid the appearance of impropriety in everything they do. The decision that came this month stemmed from a case in Miami-Dade County. It was a law firm there that wanted a specific judge removed from a case because the judge was Facebook friends with the lawyer involved in the case.
But while the Supreme Court said that's okay, Justice Jorge Labarge said new judges who have Facebook accounts should get rid of them. Now, this is the same justice who enthusiastically welcomed the state's highest court to Facebook in January when it first began streaming from the courtroom on Facebook Live.
Today is the first time in our history that we are officially broadcasting a courtroom event on Facebook Live.
So interesting to hear a little bit of laughter and a little bit of applause there as the state Supreme Court took this step into social media. The high court moved earlier this year to increase that social media footprint, began showing proceedings on Facebook Live. It's actually been more than 40 years since the Florida Supreme Court first began allowing cameras in the court. The court became one of the first in the world to stream live video on its website way back in the dial-up days of 1997. It broke new ground
it
again this year.
It pains me to even think of those days,
can
Tom.
You, maybe you've got an AOL email account somewhere hidden that you can blow the dust off of. But pretty amazing. That was way back in 97 when the Florida Supreme Court began putting live video on the website. Now this year, taking another step with Facebook Live, becoming one of the first courts in the world to use social media in this way. The court made this announcement, fittingly enough, Melissa, on its Facebook page.
Where else? Now, back in January, we spoke about this landmark decision and the overall issue of cameras in the courtroom, not just here in Florida, but how this is playing out actually all over the country with a journalist who has studied this extensively. Let's listen back now to our conversation with Carrie Johnson, NPR justice correspondent in Washington.
Carrie, thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. How unprecedented is it for a state Supreme Court to have this kind of social media footprint?
Well, as somebody who's covered the federal courts for over 20 years, I can tell you that this would be an extraordinary step to happen in any U.S. court. In fact, the Judicial Conference, which is the policymaking body for all the federal courts, currently has a ban on recording audio or video of any district court proceeding in the country. So the fact that states are starting to move in this direction even a little bit is a fairly remarkable turn of events.
And Carrie, for years, media organizations have pushed for greater access for both still photography and video photography in federal court and at the Supreme Court. And the argument has been that allowing electronic media in particular into the courtroom would somehow disrupt the judicial process. Is the action here in Florida going to maybe put the lie to that traditional argument, which, you know, reporters have argued for some time now is an anachronistic argument?
Well, federal judges have argued not only that there's a possibility of disrupting the proceedings, but also made some arguments about security, both for themselves and for witnesses who are testifying in criminal cases. I can tell you that in the last year and a half alone, several federal appeals courts, including the Ninth Circuit, which is based on the West Coast in California, the D.C. Circuit here in Washington, D.C., and the Fourth Circuit, which is headquartered in Virginia, have started to do some audio, some live audio. They did that in the travel ban arguments last year over President Trump's executive order restricting travelers from 6 or 8 different countries. And there were no problems at all, logistical, security, or otherwise. There was intense interest. In fact, some news organizations even broadcast that audio live on the air of the travel ban argument. It helped educate the public and help people get in touch with the main issues under debate in Washington and in the White House and in Congress. No problems at all. They're sort of contradicting the argument from some federal judges that there'd be a disruption.
And demystifying this sort of secretive process as well, it seems.
Absolutely demystifying. In fact, there is a group based here in Washington called Fix the Court. It argues for greater transparency on the U.S. Supreme Court and the other federal courts around the country. And Fix the Court says at different points in time, all 9 sitting Supreme Court justices have expressed some interest in live audio and video coverage at the Supreme Court. But this group says that once justices actually take the bench on the Supreme Court, they change their tune. So there's something about getting on the Supreme Court that makes them change their mind and sort of close their mind a little bit with respect to openness and transparency of proceedings. In fact, it was only in the last few months that the Supreme Court developed an electronic case filing system and put on the internet some case files. In the past, you had to find another service to do that for you or pay for it. So it's very slow in coming change when it comes to the highest court in the country.
Carrie, how likely is the federal system to look at the experiment in Florida and the Florida Supreme Court by welcoming a Facebook Live into court proceedings in the highest court in Florida as they consider opening themselves up to this kind of electronic participation?
You know, that's going to be an argument that some of these transparency groups continue to make with the high court. At this point, the court releases audio, the Supreme Court, usually at the end of every week, which makes it a little less useful for regular people who want to follow court activity or even broadcast outlets like ours. If you don't only get the audio at the end of the week, the case is already over, and you may not be covering it in the same way. I think it would be extraordinary for the Supreme Court to open itself up to video. There was some video coverage of a ceremony honoring the late Justice Antonin Scalia, but that's as far as the Supreme Court has wanted to go, the U.S. Supreme Court here in D.C.
It's so fascinating because studies have shown that when you put cameras on a subject, any type of subject, their behavior changes. So it will be interesting to watch in real time how these justices behave once Facebook Live is streaming them live to the world here from Florida. And how many viewers they get, how many people tune in on Facebook to see what they're doing.
You know, judges as a whole, on the whole, like their anonymity in some ways. They like to be able to go to the grocery store or the park and not be recognized. So it will be interesting to see if some of that changes, particularly if the Florida Supreme Court gets a particularly high profile criminal case or something that really captures the attention of residents there. That said, there's a little bit of a double standard when it comes to some of the most famous judges or justices in the country. Remember that several of the Supreme Court justices, including Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Clarence Thomas, and others, have written books, appeared on 60 Minutes and other big programs, big national programs, to advertise their books, sometimes go on speaking tours to advance the cause and sales for their books, but they don't want to let cameras in the Supreme Court. And that's a bit of a contradiction, which I find hard to grapple with.
Mm.
Carrie Johnson with NPR, thanks so much for your time today on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate it, Carrie.
My great pleasure.
Joining us now here in Miami is the man behind the Florida Supreme Court's first foray into online video back in the late 1990s. Justice Gerald Kogan served as the state's highest court chief justice from 1996 through 1998. He served on the court from 1987. Justice Kogan, welcome to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Are you hearing echoes of your consideration in the mid-90s, even today, as the Supreme Court is taking maybe the next logical extension of your decision with cameras and now moving from cable television into online video?
Well, the interesting part is I think the entire court system in the United States, the federal, the states, have made a huge mistake by delaying this particular activity.
Why is that?
Well, quite frankly, back in 1975, when Florida first adopted cameras in the courtroom, everybody thought that that was going to be terrible because they felt the attorneys would play to the cameras, the judges would play to the cameras. Well, when it came into being, a few of them did, but within a couple of years, that all disappeared because the cameras became part of the courtroom scene. When I became Chief Justice in 1996, we adopted a program of actually opening up the court to everybody. And I managed to convince the committee that represented the state and had bought the machinery that went up into the heavens and everything. And
the satellite technology.
The satellite technology. And convinced them to let the court use it because the governor was using it, the state legislature was using it, and as a matter of fact, they wanted to charge us, the court system, when they were not charging the governor's office or the legislature. So I went in front of them and I said, we are the third equal branch of government, and we want our citizens to know and understand what's going on in the court system.
And of course, Justice Kogan, people can express their opinions about this on Facebook Live instantly to the court. They'll be able to instantly comment on the proceedings before the state's high court. How do you think that will impact the way justices are considering the cases as they get this instantaneous social media feedback that they didn't get before?
Well, the only question that I have is whether or not they're going to pay any attention to it. I mean, it's not like you're saying during the hearings in front of the court that somebody can ask that question and the court has to stop and answer it. Absolutely not. There will be no change, in my mind, doing it on the Facebook as it was that I started doing it on the Internet. As a matter of fact, we were the first court in the world that went ahead and put its oral arguments on the Internet so people could just dial right in. So whether they're going to shoot their questions by way of Facebook or whether or not they're going to go ahead and do it by writing letters to the court, which they used to do, there's not going to be that big a change. I think the big change is the amount of people, and I understand there's something like 2 billion out there as an audience on Facebook that will have the opportunity now to go ahead and see it.
Yeah, I mean, a much bigger audience than the dial-up internet days, certainly, right? It's lot easier to watch it on Facebook Live than when we all had to dial up to watch something.
True. But it's not going to change what the court is going to do. Basically, I saw that in our court, the judges voted the way they felt they should on particular courts. And if you've got qualified judges, they're going to go ahead and that's what they're going to do.
You mean the Facebook Live comment from Gator Baby 32 isn't going to isn't going to influence the esteemed bench at the Supreme Court?
Oh, I'm sure of that.
Listen, we're talking about Facebook Live in the highest court in the Sunshine State, the Florida Supreme Court. Former and retired Chief Justice Gerald Kogan is along with us. You are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. Let's go to Cooper City, where David is on the line. David, welcome to the program. Your thoughts on this?
Hi, I think it's fantastic. I actually just graduated from Nova Law last year, and I remember having to go on to the NPR affiliate's website up in Tallahassee and to listen or watch the oral arguments, and it was really difficult doing that on my cell phone because I would do it oftentimes when I'm driving. Now it's on Facebook Live, it's a lot easier. All right, thank you very much.
All right, we appreciate it. Justice Kogan, how about the level of understanding, though, that the public is going to need in order to have some meaningful back and forth, meaningful understanding of what's happening at the high court. I mean, an oral argument and a certain amount of trial procedure can get pretty arcane somewhat quickly at the level of the Supreme Court. So what's the risk of putting that on camera for a broader audience that may not have a sophisticated understanding of the law and how proceedings have to happen in a court, which is much different than, for instance, Melissa, in a radio call-in show?
Well, I think it becomes an educational experience. In other words, heretofore, very, very few people except attorneys and litigants have managed to see the court in action. This gives the average citizen the right and the experience of listening to the arguments, listening to the attorneys present their cases, listening to the questions that the court may be asking. And I think most people are really going to enjoy the fact that they have this opportunity.
Let's go to Mary in Pompano. Mary, what do you think about Facebook Live before the state Supreme Court?
Hello. I'm very happy you took that call. My personal feeling is we are getting so much information that's construed as fake news. The more that we can be absolutely present for any of the real events that are happening, without question, it is reality and therefore cannot be construed as anything but what it is. And I think it's a fabulous idea. I think we need more of it in other venues. The truth is the truth, and by gosh, nobody can doubt it if they see it live in the courtroom.
Thanks for that. Yeah, Justice Kogan, it's just simply a live stream. And I was thinking about this, too, when we heard about this. Imagine if this had existed in the year 2000 when the state Supreme Court was issuing its rulings around the Florida recount, about those undervotes in Florida. That would have been an interesting spectacle to behold, too.
Well, actually, I believe they were.
Was that streamed?
Yes, it was. So they would be able to see it.
But it was a smaller audience, right? I mean, there weren't as many people going online to look at that.
Well, that's because they didn't have the luxury of being members of Facebook.
Yeah, right. No Facebook.
They had to do a little work, to find out where to dial in.
Justice Kogan, you instituted this in 1997. I think for those of us, Melissa, of a certain age, when we talk about cameras in the courtroom, we think about a certain criminal murder case in Southern California in the early 1990s, this being the O.J. Simpson murder case and the cameras there. What lessons did you take away from that spectacle as you put courtroom cameras in place in the Supreme Court in Florida in the late 90s and what we should keep in mind even today?
Well, basically, this is the court, the highest one in the land, if the U.S. Supreme Court joins in. And I have doubts that they'll join in anytime soon based upon what I've noticed about the court and its desire to not let the people see everything, because for some strange reason, they seem to feel it's not dignified. I think it's one of the most dignified thing that any court can do. And I think the people have the right to watch what the third branch of government is doing without having to come all the way to Tallahassee or go all the way up to Washington, D.C., hoping they're going to get a seat in the courtroom. This is something that goes to transparency in government and should be followed by every citizen.
Former and retired Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court, Gerald Kogan, along with us here on the Florida Roundup. Chief Justice, thank you for your service and thanks for your thoughts today. We appreciate it.
And still to come, reminders of the Confederacy throughout Florida, from street names to statues, here on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Thanks for listening and happy Thanksgiving. Today, we are presenting an encore program, so we're not taking any of your phone calls this week. This past summer, a new report was released finding that even though dozens of monuments and tributes to the Confederacy have been removed across the country over the past few years, including some here in Florida, nearly 2,000 of them still remain standing.
Now, the count comes from the Southern Poverty Law Center, and they found thousands of publicly supported monuments and other reminders of the Confederacy are still in place across the country. Now, keep in mind, not just the South. This includes everything from statues to place names, state holidays, and other symbols. The study was called Whose Heritage, and it found that three states stand out for having far more monuments than others: Georgia, Virginia, and North Carolina. But here's the thing. The other eight states next on the list that seceded from the Union have their fair share as well. And yes, you're right, that includes the Sunshine State.
Yeah, you can find reminders of the Confederacy in places all across Florida. Some statues, certainly in street names and place names, absolutely. 26 markers are dotted across the state. In June, we spoke about these findings with Heidi Byrock. She's director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Heidi, thanks so much for joining us. Now, your study found nine symbols honoring the Confederacy in Florida that have actually been removed since the church attack in Charleston back in 2015. What are those symbols here in the Sunshine State?
Sure. So the nine were four monuments, some street names, and a school, just as some examples of changes in Broward County. Roads, including Forest Street, Hood Street, and Lee Street, had their names changed. In Gainesville, there was a monument removed and the name of a building changed in 2017. Another monument came down in Bradenton in 2017. So those are examples of the kinds of things that have happened.
Heidi, how substantial would you describe those changes?
That's actually pretty substantial for the states that we're looking at. Texas actually removed the most such monuments, 31, but nine put Florida in the running. And, you know, these are difficult processes to go through. So it's nice to see that this has happened in Florida.
Now, were these Florida symbols that went up during the Civil Rights era, the Jim Crow era, or maybe right at the turn of the 20th century? When did the majority of these get put into public squares?
Well, there's basically two periods when most of the symbols went up, and it was not, as some people assume, right after the Civil War ended in 1865. The big building periods were the 1920s and then during the Civil Rights era when these changes actually happened. And most of the monuments that I'm referring to went up in the 1920s. Things like the Monument to the Women of the Confederacy, for example, in Duval County, which, by the way, is the place with the most such symbols in Florida. There's 12 there.
Now, that's right. Here in Jacksonville, there's even a local movement called Take 'em Down Jacks working to try to get those symbols removed. And, Tom, you know, the report even shows an increase in identified Confederate symbols around the country, not just here in Florida as well.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, Heidi, because as you've gone through your databases and continually combed through the United States looking for these kind of Confederate symbols, you've actually seen an increase in them. Is that because there's new Confederate symbols that are being erected or new street names, or is it just a different recognition over previous surveys?
Yeah, so we did a survey like this 2 years ago. It was the first time ever that anyone had tried to collect all Confederate monuments from around the country in one place. There was no sort of database related to that. And at the time, we were able to document about 1,300. This report has a little bit more than 1,700 of them. And that is largely because people have helped us crowdsource where these things exist. We've also gotten access to some new databases that exist that try to collect this information. So it's the result of people paying more attention and actually documenting where these monuments exist. But this is sort of the only survey that exists like this of everything Confederate related.
You mentioned most of the symbols in Florida that have changed, monuments and street names particularly. But the Southern Poverty Law Center has identified five counties here in the state of Florida, and there's only 67 that make up the entire state, but five of them named after Confederate-era leaders. How should those be addressed?
Well, our view on all of this, whether it's a county name, and this is actually something that's common throughout the Deep South, not just something that exists in Florida, or a courthouse monument and whatnot. We are very much emphasizing that local communities should take the lead on this. And, you know, we've seen these takedowns happen, whether it's in New Orleans or the ones, the nine that have been removed in Florida, because people didn't really realize the history here. First of all, they didn't understand that most of these monuments went up in periods to remind, to essentially challenge the idea of Black civil rights. And so our goal is to get communities involved. We actually even have a community action guide and have them take it upon themselves to work through this process, think about the history, and think about how they want their local communities or counties to be seen by the world and the rest of the United States.
Would you anticipate a municipality change its name? Have you heard of that kind of take it down movement going to that level?
We don't have any documentation of something like that. For the most part, it's been sort of statues mm-hmm. and school names and road changes. But I think it's entirely possible that this could happen. You know, we went for 150 years after the Civil War was a process of adding more markers of the Confederacy, more homage to white supremacy across this country. But since the Dylann Roof shooting in 2015, all of a sudden there's been a shift in the way people think about this. And I don't see why it's not possible to see counties change their names, like Lee County in Florida, mm-hmm. As a result of thinking seriously about what the Confederacy meant, what it fought for, which was slavery.
And what's the reaction been to this published report, Heidi? Just looking at the sheer number of these memorials and monuments, I think has been eye-opening for a lot of people, how many of them there still are, and frankly, not just only in the South.
Yeah, that's true. These monuments exist all over the country, and I think that's very important to point out. This isn't just in the Deep South. The reaction is we've got a lot of people from all over the country reaching out to us, in particular to find out, like, what is the way to go about confronting this issue. We've also heard from folks on advisory boards in different places who are looking into this issue to get a better sense of what the history is. And it's been quite interesting and eye-opening, I think, for a lot of people. First of all, to even recognize maybe this is in their backyard, and then to know the real history about how they came to be. So we're continuing those conversations with people across the country, and especially in the South, where the bulk of them are.
In that conversation, what are the questions to be asked by a community to determine the fate of these symbols, be it a monument or the name of their local county?
Well, oftentimes what they want to know more about who the figure is that's being honored, or the idea, right, for example, which also happens in some places. But also often they want to know what have been the processes that have happened in other places, right? What happens at the county commission level, for example, if they're in control of that? Or what happens when there are advisory boards like exist, for example, in Houston right now, looking into these issues? And also they often want to know what is the story of schools who have gone through the process of changing their names, right? How do you deal with students, parents, community members? So we're just trying to provide as much information as we can about how this has worked out in other places and worked out in a good way for the community.
Well, Heidi Byrick, we so appreciate you being with us. She's director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project. The new report is called Whose Heritage? Heidi, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Fascinating report there. Meanwhile, some like State Representative Jay Fant have been saying they think monument removals should actually be made illegal.
I believe that taking down statues is erasing history. If we want to put up statues of Mary Bethune, we should, just like we are doing with the Florida Slavery Memorial in Tallahassee, and I support that. But to whitewash history because today one war is out of vogue or one thought out of vogue is a dangerous place for civilized society to be.
You know, this debate over what to do with these public monuments is still very fresh here in Florida. So how should these symbols be treated, especially those that are on public land and public buildings? Rodney Hurst is a civil rights icon in North Florida, the author of books about the era. It was never about a hot dog and a Coke, and unless we tell it, it never gets told. He's also a member of Jacksonville's Task Force on Civil Rights History and joins us at WJCT in Jacksonville. Rodney, how do you hear this debate today? And when you hear that nine Confederate-era symbols have been removed in Florida in the last 3 years, how does that make you feel?
Well, I guess there is no no feel about how it makes me feel. These symbols are racist. These symbols come from an era that we have romanticized in this country, a war that has been misappropriated and hijacked, the issue of why the war was fought. The war was fought to maintain slavery. The whole concept of the lost cause, where those who fought for the Confederacy, in effect fighting to maintain slavery, now feel it is upon them to put statues and memorials to romanticize and memorialize the Civil War, and there is no memorializing or romanticizing a war about slavery and statues designed to promote and support racism. It's one of those processes where it just takes political courage on the part of those white elected officials to acknowledge. I always hear elected officials and white folks say, well, this is part of history. Yet no white person who supports statues to Confederate memorials and different monuments or naming schools after Confederate generals have ever acknowledged that the Civil War was fought to maintain slavery. And every secessionist paper that was presented by one of the states that seceded said in those papers that the reason they seceded was because of slavery.
And now with this new report that's come out showing just the sheer number of these monuments, as you said, they are being removed in some parts of the country, Rodney, where the political will exists. But that can vary a lot from state to state and even different cities within a state. Like here in Florida, there's certainly more will in the southern part of Florida to do this than up in North Florida, say.
Yes. Political will. Jacksonville does have small step, but still Jacksonville did rename Nathan Bedford Forrest to West Side High. The students did. When you understand that Nathan Bedford Forrest was named in 1959 based on a recommendation by the Daughters of the Confederacy to the Duval County School Board to name a school after the founder of the Klan, a slave trader, the first imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, and the Fort Pillow Butcher. Usually when you name something after someone, especially a school, there is some redeeming value. And then I hear the comparison, well, you know, there's a school name for Mary McLeod Bethune. There should be a school name for Robert E. Lee. They are not equals in terms of historical significance and importance. We're dealing with situations where you have a Confederate general fighting to maintain slavery. I mean, that is, you repeat that over and over, no matter how much you try to deny that. You cannot escape. That's the reason that the war was fought.
We have seen these monuments and these statues and local efforts to remove them or to place them in museums to be real lightning rods for demonstrations, some of them civil, some of them incredibly violent. How, as communities think about these symbols, Rodney, how do you balance that kind of public safety concern over some of these debates? And we've seen that to some degree even on display and during this 90 minutes of public comments in Fort Myers, the concern about public safety and this fate over this bust of Robert E. Lee was brought up.
It's amazing whenever we talk about public safety, when we talk about the civil rights movement, it's almost as if there is some violence that the violence was perpetuated by something. Violence was not perpetuated by anything. Violence has been the reaction by Southern whites to civil rights and also in support and protecting their symbols of racism and the Civil War. Black folk don't get out and carry lanterns and torches in support of what they believe in, and certainly there have been no civil rights movements or no support of an effort where the black community has rioted or they have been violent as a result of removing a statue. They have been, for the most part, most civil rights demonstrations have been peaceful. And even those who advocate removing those symbols, they've done it in a peaceful way. The reaction has always been violent. So when there is a public safety issue, it's not a public safety issue by those who are advocating the removal or placing them someplace else. It's been those who have been trying to protect these images and these symbols of white American racism.
This is a conversation you're continuing as a member of the City of Jacksonville's Task Force on Civil Rights History. This has been a long and winding process that has really started to speed up finally now, particularly as we learned after the 2015 massacre in Charleston, but one that hopefully will continue here in Florida.
Well, President Anna Broche recommended and appointed the Civil Rights Task Force in February, and we've been working on that since that time. So we're putting together a civil rights timeline.
That's right. And some discussion about whether it will continue and in what capacity. But we'll follow that along with the ongoing issue of removing Confederate monuments from across Florida, the South, and even the country. Rodney Hurst, always a pleasure to see you. Thank you for joining the Florida Roundup.
My pleasure, Melissa.
And that was our conversation from June with Rodney Hurst, a civil rights icon. Hurst worked to integrate Jacksonville's public places in the 1960s as a young activist. He's also the author of books about the era, including It Was Never About a Hot Dog and a Coke, and Unless We Tell It, It Never Gets Told, a local North Florida icon, Tom.
And earlier we heard from Heidi Byrock. She's director of the Intelligence Project at the Southern Poverty Law Center. Still to come on this encore presentation of the Florida Roundup, a conversation with veteran television journalist Dan Rather on civility and unity, how to bring Americans together. You are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to an encore presentation this week of the Florida Roundup. Thanks for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Hope you're having a great Thanksgiving holiday and looking forward to the holiday season. Well, today we decided to present an encore program, so we won't be taking your calls. But this is a conversation we really wanted to listen to again. About a year ago, we spoke with veteran journalist Dan Rather. Now, of course, most people, most older Americans, that is to say, know Rather from his decades at CBS News. But in recent years, he has emerged as something of a millennial media star as well on his Facebook page and other outlets. At a deeply polarizing time in this nation's history, Tom, Rather has really emerged as a voice of reason and integrity with a fan following that spans all ages and demographic groups. You know, as he writes passionately, oftentimes on social media, about what it means to be an American.
Yeah, and, you know, we thought it would be interesting to listen back to this conversation that we had with Rather 12 months ago, given all the polarization that's happened, given everything that happened just within the last couple of weeks in the state of Florida here, Melissa. And I don't know about your Thanksgiving table, but even what may have happened the last 24 hours at people's Thanksgiving tables.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe politics was banned from a conversation over the holidays. Maybe instead it was about patriotism, for instance, what it means to be an American, or how important it is to vote and to get involved. All of those certainly are worthwhile topics, maybe less polarizing than talking about the politics of America these days. You know, Rather has been in broadcasting for decades, starting in the 1960s, of course, and he has found...
He started, he found prominence with hurricanes. Hurricane Carla, that's what brought him to national prominence.
That's right, when he was a reporter in Texas and caught the eye of CBS and then, of course, traveled the globe as a CBS reporter and a news anchor and, of course, a reporter for 60 Minutes as well. But as you mentioned, brand new following in the 21st century, thanks to his millions of followers on social media, tracking his posts mostly on Facebook about the state of the nation. And so a year ago, we had the chance to speak with Rather. He had just released a collection of original essays reminding us of the principles upon which the United States was founded. The book is entitled What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Here's our conversation from last November.
Dan Rather, a pleasure. Thanks for being on the Florida Roundup.
Well, great to be with you, Melissa and Tom. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, we so appreciate your time and so much to talk about inside the pages of your new book. But I'd like to begin first by noting, as Tom said, this book is made possible in part by your incredible social media following you've built in the years since you left CBS News. What's that been like for you, and did it take you by surprise?
It took me by complete surprise. I've been away from CBS News for 12 years. I've continued to work full-time for, among other people, Mark Cuban, who's an entrepreneur out of Dallas, on his Axis TV channel, which is a cable and satellite channel. But this surprised me, and I do want to say I'm very grateful for it. I had no idea that we could reach this many people on social media. I'm still, frankly, in awe of it, but I do appreciate it very much. And my experience on my Facebook page and then another Facebook page, which we call News and Guts, which deals with news of the day, encouraged me to start thinking about a book. But you know, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism, is not a screed about the Trump administration. In fact, President Trump has not even mentioned it. But we all know we're in a particularly divisive time in the country, and it's a perilous time for the country in many ways, a dangerous time, one of the more dangerous times we've had during my lifetime. But if I can bring anything, and I'm not sure I can, I am, humble about things. I know humility is not a word normally associated with present or past television anchor people, but nonetheless, I'm not an expert on anything, much less patriotism. But my hope for this book, first of all, I wrote it in a spirit of hope and optimism for the country. I recognize that a lot of people are very worried and are not very optimistic about the country, but I'm an optimist by nature and by experience.
Dan, let me ask you the irony of being encouraged to write this book about what unites the United States from social media, which has been so much the source of the divisiveness and the real polarization that Melissa spoke about. How do you put those two things together?
Well, not very well is the answer. It is ironic. And you make a very strong point. There is irony in that. But, you know, I feel so strongly that if people just stop, take a breath, lower their voice, and we talk to each other in a civil manner, which has gone a little out of fashion to talk with civility anymore, and if we remind ourselves what has brought our great country to this point, and particularly, and I do want to emphasize this point as I do in What Unites Us, the difference between patriotism and nationalism, these two things are not mutually exclusive, but there is a difference between patriotism and nationalism. The biggest difference is patriotism does have an element of humility. Patriotism, true patriotism is, listen, I love my country, I know my country's great, but we don't go around beating our chest about it. We try to learn from other people. We try to have respect for other cultures. Mm-hmm. Nationalism goes a bit the other way. There's a strain of arrogance in nationalism, particularly extreme nationalism, which can be dangerous because it leads extreme nationalism can lead to nativism and then descend into tribalism. And if we ever reach the point in this country where we descend into tribalism, then we'll have a different kind of country. Again, I'm not preachy about it. I just want to remind people that that's what's at stake.
And you mentioned a minute ago, you feel that we're at a dangerous inflection point in this country. But when you look at those trends overall, though, your book is optimistic. You focus on the things that bring us together rather than the things that tear us apart.
I do.
It's a hopeful book.
It is a hopeful book, but a realistically hopeful book, recognizing that, look, we've got challenges. we are being tested. We're being tested as to what our future is going to be. But I'm so convinced that if we just remind ourselves that we Americans agree on much more than we disagree. And frankly, and I say this gently, but I'm tired of hearing all these voices, frequently from political leaders, who are trying to further divide us along lines of race and religion and ethnicity. I'm so tired of hearing these voices of division, which they say these things and they do these things to divide us because they think it's to their partisan political and or ideological advantage.
Dan, let me ask you, you've seen America at some of its most divisive moments. You covered the civil rights movement in the early 1960s in Mississippi and in Georgia and Alabama. You covered Vietnam, of course, domestically as well as internationally. How do you think today's division compares?
Well, today's divisions in some ways compare, but I'm glad you raised the point, because by raising that point, you remind us we've been through some really difficult times in the past. The 1960s, which you mentioned, they were a terribly divisive time. We had race riots in the streets, assassinations of leaders. The war was divisive. And, of course, we had the catastrophic civil war in the 1860s. So, you know, the historical perspective that I try to give is we've been through tough times before, and no ducking and dodging it. This is a tough time. But it's not any worse than some of the times we've gotten through before. However, we can't get through it by just wishing that we get through it, that we have to take action. And the most important action, of course, is get to the ballot box. Because for those people who feel like, you know, that we've made a mistake with President Trump, for those people, revenge is best served at the ballot box. And in the end, that's the single most important act people can take. But on a day-to-day basis, just reaching out and doing something, one thing each day to help some other person and help the community is a brand of patriotism, because it helps the country.
And as someone who spent your storied career in media, in broadcast media, how do you think the media has performed its role as a watchdog through the election and now going into this presidential administration's first year?
Well, I want to make clear, when I say the media, I prefer the word press, but the media has made its mistakes. I've made my mistakes. That none of us, we're not perfect. But the answer to your question, I don't think that the press in general, including myself for that matter, did a very good job of its watchdog role during the nomination process. President Trump took full advantage. This is not a criticism of him, but he got a tremendous amount of free time, particularly on television, but also in print and radio, free time because he's a very good performer. And the media did not ask nearly enough tough questions or tough follow-up questions. And even during the election campaign, while it was somewhat better, not all that much better. However, since President Trump has become president, I do see signs that the media is doing a better job. There's been some really terrific investigative reporting done, all for the better, because that's one of the key roles the press plays in being part of our system of checks and balances on power.
So how can an American, Dan, become a better media consumer, a better consumer, an audience of the press?
I'm glad you asked, because it's a long list, but I'll try to keep it short.
Well, you're as a broadcaster.
In 30 seconds.
You've got 30 seconds, Dan.
All right. Number one, be skeptical but not cynical. Number two, try to get your news from a wide variety of channels and places. Don't get into a silo and just tune in or read something that agrees with your own prejudices and predilections. So be a wise consumer, and also try to find those places where people are doing quality journalism and actually doing reporting.
Dan Rather speaking to us last November.
And that's our show today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Our producer is Bridget O'Brien.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. WLRN's Director of Radio Operations is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos. More at aaronlibos.com. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy holidays. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great holiday weekend. We'll be back next week.